start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello, I'm Sean, and you're listening to the Left Wingers podcast. We are an unashamedly left-wing political podcast made by activists for activists. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about an issue which is close to my heart and one that we've been eager to cover for a long time now. In support of Autism Awareness Month being in April, we wanted to host an episode dedicated to what it's like to live with conditions that aren't necessarily visible to people that we don't know. Hidden disabilities are conditions that are not immediately apparent to us just by looking at someone. These range from chronic illnesses to mental health issues, sensory processing and learning difficulties, and even some physical problems as well. Globally, 1 in 7 of us live with a disability, and a staggering 80% of those are hidden. Life with a disability is hard enough as it is, but when you live with a condition that other people can't see, it becomes even more difficult. We've invited some fantastic guests onto the podcast today to talk about their experiences of living with hidden disabilities and discuss what can be done to change public perception, influence UK policy and legislation that affects disabled people, and essentially ensure those of us who live with any kind of disability have the same quality of life as those who are able-bodied.
Thank you so much to all of our guests for joining us today. If you'd like to introduce yourselves, but also, and this is maybe seems a bit out of place for such a serious topic, but we do think it's worthwhile to kind of allowing the flow of discussion to happen. We'd like you to answer one of our questions to warm you up for whinging. What is your favourite type of potato? So please introduce yourselves and tell us what your favourite type of potato is.
Hi everyone, I'm Georgia, a history and politics student. I've got multiple diagnoses and I'm currently pursuing further diagnoses. And the very important question of the day, I'd have to say my favourite form of potato is mashed potato, but it has to be well seasoned, else I'll throw it in the bin.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. My name is Anastasia. I'm a PPE student at St. John's College, Oxford. Currently, I am running for chair of Labour Students, and I have diagnosed dyslexia, and I'm waiting on an ADHD assessment. My favorite type of potato, I'm going to be super boring and go with French fries. So sorry about that.
It's a solid choice. Don't worry about it.
I'm Milo Bund. I work in social housing, be a policy for public affairs. I'm dyslexic dyspraxic, been diagnosed for over 20 years. Also do a bit of fair work in sort of trade union stuff, so with union centre, with my students, so I have no disability from that side of things, and also chair the Young Babies Disability group. So yeah, I'm looking forward to being involved, discussion, and in terms of favourite potato, I reached out for you meant sort of types. So I was going to say King Edward, because somebody said I look like Edward VII, who they're named after, but mash is a good one. I say roast, just because I got nostalgia for a good English roast, and it's St. George's Day today, so it makes sense.
That's great. Great choice. So, first question is, if you get my sharing, of course, when were you first diagnosed, and or if you're not diagnosed, when did you sort of first realise that maybe you might have the conditions that you live with?
So I first started down the path of diagnosis when I was in year 10 for my narcolepsy, which I'm currently still under investigation for, because obviously delays due to the pandemic. And then for my further conditions, it really started when I was in year 12. And now I'm diagnosed with fibromyalgia and Sjogren's syndrome, but I'm waiting on further tests for further conditions.
Great. Okay. Thank you for sharing that, Georgia. Anna?
I was diagnosed in October, November, give or take, of 2021. So it was the last year of my A-levels. I first realized it because I always took longer than my classmates to finish an essay. I had a lot of spelling mistakes and, you know, my teacher always used to comment on them. Actually, my politics teacher used to be so harsh that for spelling mistakes, she used to actually take away marks, which obviously meant that I always got a D grade, C grade. So yeah, I always, when I was a kid as well, I did have a lower academic performance compared to my classmates. But because I used to live in the Middle East, dyslexia is not really a subject that is well talked about. Usually there, as far as my experience goes, if you're not good with studying, usually you're just branded as dumb or, you know, simply not good. And yeah, so it just, my family never got a diagnosis or anything because it wasn't a thing really. But when I came here and I realized all of this is happening during my A-levels, I tried to get a diagnosis and I asked my mom about, you know, how was I as a kid in school? And she described exactly what the teachers used to say, that Anas used to, for example, get distracted, or Anas used to make spelling mistakes or whatever. And yeah, I realized, yeah, I'm probably dyslexic. I need to check that out. So that's my experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Wow. Thanks for sharing that though. Milo?
Yes, I was about 6 or 7, around that age. So I got diagnosed with dyslexia and dyspraxia. Don't know what other tests were taken. But yeah, like, for example, my teacher apparently commented that I shouldn't be in mainstream education, but my parents really sort of fought for that. So I, you know, I'm sure we can talk about some of this issue, but yeah, it's, I can't really remember what I saw initially, but it's always been there. So we got a teacher identified. There was definitely a disconnect on what I could do in terms of spelling stuff. So I'd be verbally much more articulate than written. And it still happens today. It's even work, you know, so I'll write like, the quick brown fox jumped out of the lazy dog, however it goes, and I miss like the words out. So I'm much improved over time, but those things still apply. So I've been there 20 years and tried to prove myself, but it's still ever present. And you can definitely look, do other tests. But that's the thing, it's very hard for me to, some of these testing stuff that's new. I think it's completely different to what I was 20 years ago as a kid. So it's very much interesting to see what's similar in terms of the barriers going there, what's changed in 20 years. Because I was definitely one of the, there were people who were dyslexic in my, but it was much more niche and not as well talked about. You know, it's very much, much more open about that sort of thing nowadays in terms of conditions. So,
yeah, I get that. That's great. Thank you so much for sharing. Okay, so next we'd kind of like to talk about your experiences in education or work have been like in regards to you having a hidden disability. So if you're okay with sharing that, Georgia, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So the system itself will never be suitable for disabled people, but the efforts of my tutors and other staff never goes unnoticed to me. I get a lot of extra support from my tutors. I just wish the playing field was more even so I wouldn't need this extra support. So for me, education, I'm very grateful to be taught by a lot of extremely understanding people that understand I might not necessarily be particularly awake. I might actually fall asleep in the lectures and seminars, but they understand that's out of my control. It's not a lack of care on my part. It is a condition. And they're very understanding with sometimes I'll need things to be explained in a different way. I get brain fog and that just throws my concentration out the window, and things like deadline extensions, something that I need pretty much for all my assessments. But so far I've only had positive experiences of teachers completely respecting my needs and honoring them. But I would like to talk about the first job I ever had. And when I was 16, I worked in a restaurant, and it's potentially one of the worst experiences I've been a part of for my disability. So the shifts would be standing behind a till for 4-6 hours straight, or constantly having to make laps of this restaurant. And at the time I wasn't diagnosed with Sjogren's or fibromyalgia, so I felt I couldn't speak up about these conditions because if there's no medical evidence, I can't convince people to believe me, that they don't have a reason other than my word to believe me. So because of that, it was an incredibly stressful environment. And after shifts, I'd get horrible stress-induced flare-ups because I was in an environment that I desperately wanted to be out of. But thankfully, nowadays, I look more towards working remotely because it's not perfect. Working under capitalism will never be perfect, but it's far more adaptive. So time constraints aren't really as relevant. And my working day, it can be really molded around my mobility on that specific day. So I do find remote working to be far more accessible. And it's something I really wish would be continued even now, because if everyone could work at home through the pandemic, I don't understand why people can't still work at home. Now we're apparently on the other side of the pandemic, which is a whole other matter.
Yeah. To be honest, it's obviously different between A-levels and university. So the first year in A-levels in year 12, when you didn't have the assessment and you didn't have the extra time, you didn't have the support, you always felt like there is something wrong. There is, why am I getting D's? Why am I failing? And you used to get teachers telling you, oh, you know what? You're actually not going to get the grades at the end of the course. And no matter how hard you try, you're like, there is something wrong. So that was A-levels. And I can talk about that for a long, long time. But it affects you even at university. So at university, you have these massive reading lists. And in my diagnosis, it says that although my ability is higher than average, my reading speed is much lower than average. So, you know, I feel always behind on reading compared to other classmates. And that obviously affects your essays, the quality. And then you end up, you know, getting some kind of, and as you need to engage more with the literature. And, you know, to be completely honest, my professors were quite nice. They were trying to support. They are continually trying to provide a slimmer kind of version of the reading list. But I feel like if someone doesn't have dyslexia or ADHD, then it's harder to actually imagine how someone else who does have that would feel like. Because if you live your life normally, then it's similar to people who don't wear glasses, for example. They'd never realize how much you can't see. And every time they wear your glasses, you're like, oh, you are actually blind. Obviously, it's much difficult to study with that. But yeah, so far, I am receiving a lot of help from the university, so fair enough. But yeah, it's still difficult to get the hang of it so far.
Yeah, so it's been a mixed bag. So like when I was first diagnosed, this is early noughties, Northumberland County, well, County Council would offer 3 hours a year, so 1 hour a term. That, the grand scheme of things, that's not going to make any difference. You know, it's like going to the gym once a year, you know, you're not going to lose any weight. So I was privileged enough that I had like parents who would like financially support, like external people to keep the, you know, just be able to get the like dyslexia institute, stuff like that, to get that help and support. And it's been difficult. I think school is definitely far more difficult than university to gain that help for exams, because I think, at least I found in my experience, so I used to get extra time a lot. And even in my final year, AW, my headmaster really disliked having too many people who were dyslexic or having extra time. So he tried to actively try and limit how many people were doing that. So, you know, it's kind of different. University fairly supportive if, you know, it bureaucratic, I found for people, because I already had the right documents, it was fair enough, but lots of people who haven't got the right documents or need this, and it was fairly, like, my undergrad work, you basically got a yellow sticker, stuck it on your piece of work, and they just, so I didn't have much. Work, I think, is the trickier one, which I can, my experience, you know, for, so, you know, some talk is different to action. So you get a lot of companies that are part of Disability Confident. So Disability Confident is a scheme where if you're disabled or you meet the sort of social standard, they'll give you an automatic interview. Civil service is part of that, lots of government organisations as well as to other people. That is sort of a bit of a smokescreen because lots of... So I got a lot of interviews after leaving university, didn't get many job offers because lots of people... Because, you know, if you've got two candidates, you know, they've both got good degrees, but one's disabled, one's not, they're going to hire the non-disabled person broadly because, you know, it's less effort, less risk. And companies are naturally risk-averse. This is the thing. So I don't know how you're meant to address that, but it's something to be acknowledging that you have. It's a numbers game with that sort of thing. And then actually in work, I'm lucky my current employer is quite understanding, but I've also got union support and stuff. Like, I had to explain, I had to go. And so I think if you've got any condition, lay those things on the table straight away, get union support straight away, because it's the only way it's you're going to address it is just be honest with people. I know it can be quite difficult to talk about these conditions, where it'd be, you know, difficult to talk about, but get somebody there who can support you or talk with you. But you have, I'd strongly advise speak to them. Mention it at the interview because you can talk about how that you don't want to sort of say triumph over adversity, that sort of thing, because that could be a bit cringy in terms of, but it's something to talk about. Something to, and most people are quite empathetic. You know, I've got people who've got kids with similar condition. Most people can understand broadly, even if they don't actually understand nuts and bolts. So I trust people, even if they haven't got, they aren't disabled themselves, they probably are, most people are naturally empathetic, but you have, sometimes it is a lot of difficult to get the nooks and crannies to make a situation work for you. So try and get the support, speak to relevant organisations, speak to your trade union, and yeah. But so the current system, law companies talk a good game about diversity and inclusion, but in practice they're very difficult. Because so it's usually the bigger organisations are better at this because they've got more financial support, but yeah. It is difficult when you step into the world of work from education, because education usually has like one or two issues, whereas work is constantly changing, it's high pressure. So yeah, that's why you thought of the subject.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yep, so kind of looking more broadly than your work or education, have you faced discrimination because of your invisible disabilities in any other parts of your life at all? Is that something that you've experienced?
Sure, so I think like, a close example was probably at Skills Lake. So my headmaster really didn't like having that many. So there was an active, you know, he tried to get people retested because I think his wife was able to test. So yeah, that was, and I think it's sort of snide comments to a degree. Free teacher. I think it's because, you know, it depends how you want to do it. I can take a joke, you know, about some things, but there's definitely, I think it's more a trust issue. Can somebody do it? Because if you muck up something, one piece of work there is always going to be, that's going to linger over you. That happens in education or school. So it's more about, you have to work twice as hard as somebody else, because you have to prove yourself. You're not just nameless employee, you're nameless employee who's got disability, you know. So it's having to prove that. And again, that's difficult because everybody's difficult, everybody's got their preconceptions, everybody's coming in with that sort of thing. And I don't know how you're meant to address that, but I think being honest, being saying, I have this condition, and you can show them, because I think most people are naturally disabled, but there will be people who are going to be not so nice. So that's why you have, find those support networks, whether they be at work, externally, family. But yeah, I think there's always, I wouldn't say I'd be that discriminated against, because it's an invisible disability. So it's a bit of a, yeah, it's hard. It's a difficult one for me because it's, my disability is very different to somebody's more is visible disability or somebody's more noticeable. So my, it's hard to be blatant, but you know, it's like, it's the job stuff, you know. You know, you go for a job, you're more than qualified to. I could name names, I could name, you know, I've got a lot of experience in certain sectors, but I get an interview, but they'll be like, why has this person got the job? She's got less experiences, whatever. Is it just because they're less of a risk? You know, you're safety first. And I think that happens in business, after politics, you know, there'll be lots of people who go for Labour and B jobs who will be perfectly qualified, but because there's an asterisk over them, they're going to go for the safe choice, which I can understand from a sort of utility point of view, but it's not nice, it's not good, and we need to make a system that works for as many people as possible.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think I have lived enough to actually experience any of that yet, but I mean, again, during education, I did get a lot of teachers telling me, because obviously I did tell them that I wanted to apply to Oxford, and they told me, Anas, I don't think Oxford is for people like you. Yeah, they were comparing me to the last person who got into Oxford from that school, and that was back in 2017. And they told me that she used to read a lot, she finished a book every single week, and I'm like, well, I'm trying. So yeah, I guess you didn't even have the support of the college when you applied to uni, because some teachers thought maybe you're not that type of student. And to be fair, that was even after the dyslexia diagnosis. So I'm not sure why, you know, someone would say that. But yeah, I haven't lived yet, but I'm sure a lot of people have experienced, whether it's dyslexia or ADHD. I think, you know, especially when ADHD might not make you as focused as other people, or might get you more distracted. And can I just say, I realized that although my dyslexia, it makes it harder for me, I actually really appreciate it, because one of the other side effects of dyslexia is that you're more creative, you think about outside the box, you think differently than other people. So I truly I'm grateful for that. But when you have something like that, and especially if you don't have a diagnosis, it can be really difficult.
I just wanted to say, Anas, I think that was really interesting, the point you made about applying to such prestigious universities. I took the absolute opposite approach. When I was applying to universities, I refused to apply to any Russell groups just because I didn't want to put myself through that kind of process. So I find it really, just really brave that you were willing to put yourself out there for that. That's really commendable. So my disabilities, for the most part, they are hidden. But sometimes when I have flare-ups, that's when it becomes visible. So I find particularly the discrimination I face is a combination of my disability, my age, and my gender. Often the needs of women are pushed aside, and being a femme-presenting person, I get lumped in with that, especially because of my age. I joke that I'm a teenager trapped in an old lady's body, but after a while it stops being funny, because the reason doctors are so hesitant, or were so hesitant, to diagnose me is because they don't see young people as having the conditions that I have. They don't see young people as having arthritis. They don't see young people as having conditions that are typically had by people 40 to 60. I'm 19, so I'm quite an outlier to that. And I think that's where it gets so frustrating. Like, there's been times where I've had flare-ups and I've quite literally been sitting on the pavement with my friends, and my friends are great, but it's the looks from the strangers of, oh, are they drunk? Are they high? I mean, there's no shame in either of those, but it's, why are you not considering that this is my disability and that I need help, instead of imposing some sort of judgment on me? And I think the pandemic has definitely heightened the discrimination towards people with disabilities. Like, I'm immunocompromised, so for the pandemic to me was at a higher risk than most people were. And while I'm grateful that not everyone had to take the precautions I did, it feels kind of backwards the way it was handled. Like, disabled people need to hide themselves rather than able-bodied people taking precautions to protect disabled people. It's almost as if, I use the metaphor, it's like you're telling people to wear a bulletproof vest instead of saying don't shoot. It feels kind of a backwards narrative. And because of the pandemic, there were so many things I couldn't do. I couldn't socialize freely. I couldn't go out without a mask. I couldn't go to all these amazing events that I wanted to, because I was quite literally scared for my life and scared for the life of my family. And I think there was a lot of times that I was ostracized for taking these precautionary measures. Like, I still wear a mask nowadays, and I've been shouted at in the street, why are you still wearing your mask? The pandemic's over. Where the lives of me and so many other disabled people are still hugely shaped by this pandemic, like all the disabled people that have essentially been left to die by our government because they didn't use proper precautionary methods to protect the lives of disabled people. And I think that anger itself is a lot to carry around because I can't do anything with it. And it's sort of, I think that is a big part, questioning my identity, others questioning my identity, that's majorly difficult to deal with at the moment.
Thank you everyone for sharing your experiences there. We're going to move on to the next question. It's picking up on something that Milo, you started talking about again, and then I kind of wanted to hear more about what you had to say on the topic, and wondered if Anas and George, you had similar ideas around this. Have you had any kind of good support networks? And if so, would you feel comfortable sharing who's kind of been there to support you?
Obvious ones, my mum. I think family, I think it's very important in terms of that stuff, because, you know, they've been through the system before I could navigate the system. So they know, even if, you know, my mum will find funny because, you know, she's very much somebody loves reading, does all these other, and she's been blessed with two disabled, well, dyslexic kids. So it's quite funny. And that, but then she knows the system, she knows how to fight for it in terms of that sort of stuff. And I've got friends who talk, I can talk about stuff, who've got different conditions and that sort of thing. Union trading and stuff, in terms of that, very useful for that. More from like a practical point rather than a social point to degree. And even my, like, I can talk a bit to my line manager about stuff because she knows stuff about the system. You know, even if she's like has concerns about one or two pieces of my work, broadly, there's a sort of dialogue that's healthy and she knows she's quite empathetic in terms of understanding that point of view. So I think, you know, especially if you've got a condition, I think just reach out. And if you don't know anybody, try online, find those communities, you know, whether it be Twitter or particular things. I think just finding that network, of, even if somebody's not saying, they will, I'm not sure I'm empathetic. So I think reach out, tell your friend the condition. Of course, that can be quite tricky. So maybe, I don't know, write it out or try and, you know, record something if you want, if it's a difficult or sensitive topic. But I think give people the benefit of doubt. They will probably understand. That's my... Maybe I'm just being a bit too much of an optimist on this front, but I think that can be quite good. Because telling people is such good relief, because it's good to understand. And they'll have questions, they'll have queries. And the more you have that dialogue, it's easier in the society as a whole. Because if they ask those questions, you can sort of create a site that works for everybody.
Yeah, unfortunately, because most of my life I lived in the Middle East, and obviously because we didn't have a diagnosis or it wasn't really known, I did not have really such a strong support network or any type of support network. And when I moved to the UK, I moved obviously on my own. So I didn't have my family members here and, you know, they couldn't obviously help from abroad. I mean, I am in care, so you would assume that my social services or social workers would help. But unfortunately, even with that, the first year when I spent studying at sixth form, studied BTEC, I did not submit a single assignment. I always had a problem with like time and, you know, being focused. But yeah, unfortunately, the approach they took was more about, oh, Anna, you're not doing it because you're wasting your time doing something else. So even that, I didn't really have support from. So unfortunately, I can't answer this question, but yeah.
So initially, when I was first pursuing diagnosis for my narcolepsy, it's not that my parents were unsupportive or anything. I think it's just when you have a child, you envision their life full of ease. And because there was so much fighting, I think it was difficult for my parents to not exactly understand. It's not what you envision for your child to be at such a young age, fighting for a diagnosis and fighting for support. But now my parents, they're absolutely on top of their game. Like my dad, he's more comforting and takes the approach of, look, you're doing your best, kid. And my mum is more of the fighter, like, she's the kind of, can I have a second opinion, you know, like bordering on Karen territory. But she fights for me in that sense. So it's great because I have a dual component of support, and the new friends I've made at university, they're absolutely amazing. We are sort of a little friendship group of people with different conditions. And I think that because there's that level of understanding, that there's such a high level of empathy, and these people are truly a gift in my life because they are so loving and I never feel judged. And it's a really lovely feeling. But even before university, I had the unwavering support of my girlfriend, Demetria. She's never fazed by anything that I tell her or the support that I might request. And it's feeling like being loved completely by someone because they understand, you know, they don't question. So I think having such a strong support network that I really couldn't get through my life day to day without these people. And I'm extremely grateful because, as we've discussed today, not everyone has that privilege. And I think it can't ever be denied how important a good support network is. And absolutely everyone deserves to have that support.
Thank you so much for sharing, everyone. So we're going to go on to the next question, and that is, what do you think the UK government could be doing to improve the lives of disabled people?
So I think they really need to focus on the fact that past legislation does not stop discrimination. Yes, the 2010 Equality Act is one that we all love to bang on about, but that doesn't stop the actual workplace discrimination or discrimination elsewhere. When you think about it, there are so many discriminatory things that the government themselves do, considering they passed this act. So, well, not this specific government, but, you know, I think there needs to be definitely marriage equality. So when we think of marriage equality, we often think between people in the LGBTQ plus community. And obviously, to me, that's incredibly important. But I know if I got married, any benefits that I receive now, I wouldn't be able to receive them. And that to me is such a backwards type notion. And I think within the government, they do need to have a specialist team, because while certain MPs may be disabled or advisors or whatever, I think you can't have able-bodied people or people without disabilities making choices on the behalf of disabled people, because it's like with the glasses metaphor, you'll never truly understand. So I think because of that, you do need to have a specialist team, because that's the only way you can enforce proper accessibility. And especially with the reintroduction of monetary support, because there's been so many cuts on extra financial support and they desperately need to be reintroduced, else for some people it really can limit quality of life. And that in 2020, that's not something we should be having to think about. You know, is someone truly living a good life just because they're disabled? I think it needs to be something that's in the forefront of our minds.
Yeah, honestly, 2 points: more funding and shorter waiting list. You know, the assessment really genuinely changed my life. Like, I can't stop thinking about my life before having the assessment, and afterwards my education got better. I got finally the A-level grades that I needed. And now at university, because I got the dyslexia assessment, I managed to have a lot of support from the start. And the issue here is that I'm still, as I mentioned, I'm still waiting on the ADHD assessment. And, you know, you look at the waiting list, it's over, 18 months for the NHS. you know, the university said, oh, well, here is some private options. And even the cheapest private option, the nearest appointment is in November this year. So I know that probably if I get diagnosed, I can finally receive medication to help me with my attention and focus on reading or studying. But until then, I'm just going to have to deal with, you know, the issues that I'm facing. So honestly, more funding for assessments and a shorter waiting list.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's just money at the end of the day. Broadly, it's access to funding, whether that's universal credit, funding for proper staff training. It boils down to that. You can have all the legislation in the world, all the sort of nice sort of glossy things, but that was sort of the money payers funding. I think what I'll highlight, because I think lots of stuff's already covered, you know, we know the systems of the things, system is discriminatory, it doesn't work for most people, is the Enable Fund, which council's lasted about 18 months, which is getting disabled people running political office. So I think similar schemes have therefore been cancelled. That's something really relatively small niche funding. It could have gone a long way, it's been cancelled. It's universally popular. I was acting secretary for Disability APG for about 3 or 4 months. These are things that, you know, work across the community aisle. That tends to be disability poverty in general, because you have people who aren't necessarily political allies who work together in these sort of fields. And often it just boils down to gain our funding. But they get more disabled candidates, more people in the system, that'll create a better ecosystem. It's not going to change overnight. And if I gave you a blank check, it's not going to create a system that works for everybody. But it certainly helps. And it certainly makes something all better. So if you have that sort of system that's a bit more funded, a bit more, the wheels can just be loose. You know, I think back to my, you know, early noughties when there was a bit more funding, or was historically, you know, meant to be, three hours worth of training a year for dyslexic coverage. That's not going to difference. Any child that gets that is just like, it's a band-aid for a broken leg. You know, you're going to need something that's, you know, not, maybe not exactly tailored, but at least there's a sort of bit of specialization going into there. They can say, okay, here's your situation, here's what you're doing, here's what you're selling at, here's what makes it good, you know, and that what works at all, in all levels, if you're 75 or 17 months, you know, there's got to be, for disabled policy, there's got to be funding, and we want a system that works for all, and we're clearly not getting it, and funding needs to be there.
Okay, so just as a final point to round off this episode, what's one thing that you'd say to other young people living with invisible disabilities across the UK? And what advice would you give them?
Okay, so I'd say you're allowed to acknowledge the hardships. There are so many people who are disabled that try and sort of push it under the rug to make themselves feel better. But I promise you, by acknowledging that you have difficult days, things in turn will be easier. And if you can find the right people, I promise you that your life will be so much better. You just have to find them. And just because you are disabled, yes, it can limit your abilities and it can limit what you can do, but that doesn't mean it has to. You can do just as much as everyone else. You just have to do it in your own way. And your own way is not any less than anyone else's way. It's just a different way.
Yeah, honestly, it's not you. That's it. If you're facing any difficulties at work or education, especially if you're not diagnosed, sometimes you might get into a situation where you start blaming yourself. Maybe, okay, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I shouldn't apply for a top uni. Maybe I shouldn't do this or that. But trust me, you have the ability. And as I mentioned, sometimes our hidden disabilities might look for other people that they're a disadvantage. But sometimes we also have a lot of advantages over other people. You know, people who with hidden disabilities are much more creative. Because they experience things differently, they can look at different perspectives. And yeah, so trust me, you're not the problem. Yeah, I obviously completely hope. I know it's easier said than done that to say, oh, try and get a diagnosis or an assessment to get support. But yeah, and until you do get so, just do your best. You're amazing.
I think just if you need help, ask for it. you know, people are going to be there. Ask, you know, if you've got issues, reach out to friends, family, organisations. There'll be people there who can explain the situation. Because if you're in a situation, you're probably not the first person who's been in that situation. And on the same level, Shai Barnes getting out, you know, ask, and there's opportunities there, you know, apply for those disability confident jobs. It's go and become a disability officer for a society or organisation. Just try and, you know, if you can help out, try and be as what you can. There's so many opportunities. And it's all good, you know, if you, it's be enjoyable, it's good for CV. All these things can be achieved, you know, whether that be through, you know, your local charity, trade union, there's lots of opportunities. So take advantage, just Google that. If you've got a particular question, see what's out there. You know, they might need a social media officer for their Twitter account. You know, there's all these things that you could do that you could take an opportunity, and, you know, you could create that better world, because that's what we're all striving for. And without hope, there's nothing. So try and be helpful, you know, despite things aren't as positive as they could be.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you for listening to our podcast, and a big thank you to our guests for coming on to speak with us today about their experiences.
If you enjoyed listening to the podcast, please subscribe and be notified of when our new episodes come out. We also have a mailing list, the Left Wingers Community, which you can join using the link in this episode's description. Likewise, you can keep in touch with us using the links to our social media, which are also in the description.
Keep whinging, support your disabled friends, and we'll see you soon.